Why have I quit my job? Why have I, you know, bought a van? And why am I going to drive around the country? Well, I'm passionate about the idea that you need to be heard. And I want to stitch these stories together across the states. We're going to find the commonalities. And it's going to be really an amazing experience. And I look forward to you joining me on the job. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Mental Health Today. It's your host, Ken Stearns. Another beautiful day in Las Vegas. Going to be a hot, I think a little hot for the wintertime, but it's a little chilly out there this morning. On my travels with the Jar podcast, as you saw that little make in the van video, you know, pontificating what might be that common thread that I'd find in the stories across the U.S. And as I mentioned before in the show, it was mental health. So that led me to launch the Jar Foundation. And then ultimately to kind of find out a little bit more about the industry and what people are doing in mental health and how they got there, this show came about. So Mental Health Today is really about, you know, people, leaders in the business and what they're doing and how they got there. Caitlin, very interesting background. You know, as I was kind of snooping around your LinkedIn profile, which is how I get all my guests, you know, creeping around the back pages of LinkedIn, you know, Google searching under mental health and finding all of us soldiers in the battle out there. And Caitlin, you're one of them. And it's interesting. You're on an interesting journey. I don't know how you started it. So I kind of hope today we can find out a little bit about how you got in the space and what you're doing. And before you start solving another business's problems by trying to solve your own problems, we had a little funny backstage chat. So Caitlin, welcome to the show. How's everything going today?
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be on the Jar. I love what you're doing. I love the idea of traveling around and meeting people, you know, working at all different intersections and angles on all of this. And, you know, as much as like mental health has become such a buzzword and trauma has become such a buzzword, we're still at the very, very beginning of figuring this all out. You know, the size of the need, what the need actually is, how to address it. Do we address it through, you know, government systems, a private healthcare, you know, schools, education, family, you know, all the different angles of addressing the enormous need in front of us. And we're all at this time now where we're, you know, acutely aware of our fragile states, really, you know, since COVID.
Yeah, fragile states. Yeah.
I travel a lot for my job now and I feel that fragility, you know, people on edge, irritable, about to, you know, lose their cool in the airport or, you know, with a waiter or waitress, you know, you see it everywhere, just people on edge and not, you know, communicating in the most kind ways.
You feel it.
Yeah.
As you feel it. It's a bit of an energy. Yeah. I do see a little bit. I am seeing a bit more empathy at points as well. I have to say, I feel the tension in the edgy part, but I also feel there's a lot of humanity part of us that are going around with a bigger heart now.
That's right. People are really coming together, right? They're collaborating and trying to solve problems together. And I think, you know, we've grown in our self-awareness in general around our psychology, but then we've also, grown a lot in how we're parenting children and we're parenting from this more connected, present, mindful, you know, place. And so we're teaching empathy to our children in a way that I think previous generations didn't even have the language for, or the modeling for how to, you know, increase empathy in children. But if you can, if you can teach empathy from the time they're, you know, really little, when it comes naturally to children anyway, then it's, you know, so much easier. So I guess, I should say like how I got into the work, a little about myself. I am a mom with four kids and
they're good on you.
A big part of my journey into this work because, I guess, you know, starting back in my college years, I spent some time in Romania in the Romanian orphanages. It was at a time when they were winding down, but they still were institutionalizing children. And I spent quite a bit of time over there. And that was, you know, in a very formative time for myself in my early 20s. And I'm seeing children who have not been touched, who have not been held, not had, you know, I'm seeing firsthand attachment trauma.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing what that does to a child's development firsthand. And it does, you know, it turns a human being into something that doesn't quite feel human, to be honest. It was, you know, really, really radical to experience this before I'd had my own children. But it got me really interested in attachment trauma and child development. Okay. And I had gotten my undergrad in education and started out as a teacher. And so I was already interested in children's development, but then I got really interested in their emotional, social, you know, their mental development. So then I, you know, had my own kids and had a stint of time over in Israel while my husband was in medical school over there. And I started working with a refugee population. And these were kids who had walked from Sudan with their families, and they were left at the mercy of the community. And a Druze community up on Mount Carmel took them in, and then I worked with another woman from England to set up a preschool for the kids, so that what had happened with these families is the dads were held in detention centers and the moms were left with the kids, and then the kids weren't enrolled in school. Yep. And so then that was my first experience with family separation and what that does to the family structure and what that does to the mom's mental health, the children's mental health.
Oh God. Yeah.
And got me super, you know, super interested in refugee care and migration studies, migration focus work. And so from there, we went to Boston, and that's where my husband and I both finished our graduate degrees. And I ended up going back for a master's in human development and psychology. And so then I got to really do a deep dive
Now
you know, trauma and what trauma looks like over the lifespan, and how our mental health is implicated in all different aspects of our journey. So, that was, you know, kind of the completion of my, you know, education training. The real training happens in the field, but
I mean, that's weird. You were in the field first.
Yes. Yeah.
And then you ended up in the formal education. Yeah. Must have been a little bit interesting too, because you're really, you're being taught stuff, learning stuff, and you might have had some moments where you're going, yeah, no, you know, like some yes, like, yeah, totally. See, I've seen that on the field. That really happens. And then you'd be some things going, that's not, yeah, that's not true. Or not true, but I had a different experience.
Correct. Correct. That's the joy and joy and burden of going back to school midlife. You know, you do have the experience, the real life experience under your belt, which adds so much richness then to the curriculum and engaging with, you know, your peers and your professors and everything. But it, I think it is, you know, taking the real life experience and then, you know, reflecting in the text and textbook and the papers, paper writing and everything. And I could, you know, so many in my cohort were fresh out of undergrad, and they, because that's typical now, right? Everybody's getting their master's right after their undergrad. But for me, I'm so thankful I didn't do that, because I would have gotten a master's in education administration, you know, to become a principal or become a superintendent. And that was, you know, that wasn't my life's, that wasn't the direction I was meant to go. But going back, you know, living some life, having my children. So I'd had my four kids by the time I went back to grad school. It was actually my youngest first day of kindergarten that mommy is back in school. So we, we lined up in our, you know, back to school picture. It was really cute. And I had to wait.
That's
until, it was cute.
That's
till she was in school, because we couldn't afford for me to be a student and pay for childcare. Yeah. Yeah. So you know, I definitely had a period of time where I was in the trenches of motherhood. And I would say that those years, I mean, there's nothing harder than being a stay-at-home mom and really, you know, connecting with your children and engaging in their big emotions and small emotions and all, everything in between those years. And in my case, I do have twins in the middle. And so, and my fourth was a surprise. That means I have... For those just listening and you can't see our faces, Ken, it looks like he's delivering a child right now in his face.
It's like, oh my God. Like as soon as you said twins, and it's like, because that's a surprise. And then right. It's like, what, honey? You were what? Yeah, yes. We're pregnant again. Yeah.
That's right. Oh, that's right. Awesome. I handed my husband the positive pregnancy test on his 40th birthday. And the twins, I had just celebrated the twins' first birthday, and I had... You know, I'd cried like we made it. We made it to one. You know, everyone is still alive.
I can't imagine, right? Yeah, right.
And then a surprise, number four. So I have three boys, and then my surprise is my little girl, which is pretty special.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Okay, yeah, but I did have three under the age of two, which means I had three in diapers, and you know, in a lot of ways, it felt like triplets. And so years, you know, this is pertinent to my story because
zombie years.
Yeah, exactly. It really did break me down. It broke me down mentally. It broke me down physically. I had five surgeries in a year. It completely blew out my back carrying the twins. And I had underlying scoliosis to begin with.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then carrying twins on top of scoliosis was not helpful for.
Yeah. Not a good idea.
Not great at all. So anyway, that is how I got really fascinated with the mind-body connection and how our mental health absolutely does impact our physical well-being too. Mm. And especially in the case of chronic pain. You know, there's the biological driver of pain. You maybe a genetic link, maybe, you know, something physically broken or wrong in the body. But when the body continues to send a false pain signal, sometimes that false signal can be kept alive by, psychological drivers like depression, anxiety, PTSD.
Interesting.
So that's what led me eventually into the work that I'm doing now with cacti. So yeah, it was.
But I mean, that's such a practical journey.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm leading a pain drug development company now. But as a chronic pain sufferer, you know, it's like, this is, I hope to meet other people in the pharmaceutical industry who, and I know there are a lot are driven by their own experiences, you know, but I find it really special to interact with other pain patients and to really hear from the patient population, even though we're small molecule drug development. And that means we're preclinical long before we're in phase one clinical trials and interacting with patients, you know, we're in those early days. But I still get to hear from the pain community quite a bit, and you know, learning from their experiences, hearing how they feel dismissed, discredited, you know, that they're
the drug addicts. You know, I mean, I've heard the stories where it's just like you're going in for more. You need medication, and they're like, well, I don't know.
That's right. Yeah, you know, they're discounted for the level of pain that they're under, and chronic pain unfortunately favors women more than men. Mm. And you know, historically we've put women in the category of being hysterical or overly emotional.
Yeah, right,
and
so right.
You know, their physical experience of pain is often not given as much credibility as if a man says he's in pain. Never mind the fact that we, you know, deliver children.
I was going to say, and I thought the women's pain tolerance, maybe it's because just women have a higher tolerance of pain. You know, so we just discount, you can handle it.
That's right. Yeah. I have my theories about this, but
I don't think that's the actual theory. That's not my actual theory, but I have a feeling it's a little bit different. Probably closer to your theory.
Oh, so yeah, it's been really, really interesting to also realize how much.
Tell us about cacti too.
Yeah. So Cacti Therapeutics is early stage small molecule drug development. So we're developing synthetics. We're going the FDA long road to a new drug application, which can take, 18 months, even when you have your first molecules. I do have my first molecules synthesized now, and they're in vitro and in vivo studies. So that means cell-based and then animal-based studies. And we're trying to do that initial screening where you see if it actually hits the target you want it to hit, and it's, doing what you hypothesize your molecule will do. So it's very early stages, but we have a really special approach. It's novel. We are inducing plasticity where there's maladaptive plasticity and chronic pain. We are giving the pain neurons a chance to repair themselves. Now, this isn't typically done in pain drug development.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. You're going to go out of business.
Right. We don't want to repair anything.
What legitimate pain pill would actually repair something?
Right. Yeah. This is an uphill battle. Anything That's that gets great. At, remission or things that get it. We don't use the word cure because, you want to be very, very cautious about
away from that word.
Right, exactly. But things that, medications or therapies that bring various conditions into a remission, that's a tough sell when we're used to a medical model where we take a pill every day. We mask our pain.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You're supposed to mask pain, not cure it.
That's right. And, in the case of pain neurons that are maladaptively firing or misfiring, we've tried different approaches like blocking them, even killing the neuron. But if you think about conditions like phantom limb pain, even if you remove the appendage, that doesn't mean that you're going to be out of pain. The body, still send that pain signal.
That is right. That is interesting to think that you could kill the neuron, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Because
you cut the arm off and it doesn't matter.
That's right. Pain is centrally derived. It is not just from our periphery. It's not just in the nociceptors of the little pain neurons in our periphery, but those nociceptors send a signal to the spinal column. The spinal column sends a signal to the brain and then back down. So the signal, the pain signal is coming from the center of us really, and not just from these little neurons, on the periphery. So our approach is novel, and we'll see. We don't know if it'll work. We're going to find out,
it seems like you're at a very critical stage. You're testing it.
That's right.
I mean, you've got the little guys, and you're sending them into what, plants and other?
No. In cell-based assays, and then in animal behavioral work. So mice and rats.
Okay.
And,
so it is into, you're putting it in, it is getting into mice and rats already.
Yes. Yeah. I have two research sites right now. Queen's University in Canada is one of them. And then the Salk Institute is doing some animal behavioral work for me too.
How exciting. I mean, Yeah. I mean,
I am excited. I mean, I'm excited, and I'm the only one in the company that is not a scientist. I'm working with an entire team of pain neurobiologists.
I love that.
Yeah. Trained as pain drug developers and pain pharmacologists, immunologists. This is their area of expertise. And, I'm the one executing on the plan. That's why I'm the CEO. So I keep everybody on track, keep us moving toward our milestones in the mission. So I can, I can get really excited about our hypothesis, what's possible, what's not. And they also keep me in check that, follow the hard data, follow the science, only build on the science. We don't build beyond, so I have to be measured and remain hopeful that this new approach is going to work. And also, very sober about whether it would work or not. So.
Well, you need a dreamer and a team of scientists.
Yes, you do have to have
because
that.
A scientist will just be too scientific. Like, that's also dull and not fun. And, How do they celebrate? You know, you need someone to celebrate the little wins.
Yes.
You know, keep the energy going. You need the practical person.
That's right. And boy, we do have to celebrate the little wins in every aspect of life. Right.
And
I was just reminded of this the other day that, you know, I especially when you're working toward really big goals as a startup company or in the entrepreneurial world, you can get so focused on these, these big milestones that you forget to look behind you and see all the little things that you've accomplished. And I was thinking about this the other day, even in our family, you know, just taking time at the end of every week and celebrating these little small, happy moments in a week, instead of just always thinking forward to, you know, what's in front of us. But let's look back and celebrate the little wins.
Yeah. I mean, especially with four little ones at home, there's a lot of, I mean, it's chaos, right? The energy in the house is chaotic.
And yeah, especially since I have three in orchestra now. So we have three instruments being practiced at night. Thankfully, they're playing at the same time. But,
Now, here's a good parenting question. It's an intelligence test. Did you have any brass instruments or are these string instruments?
Thank God they are string.
Well played. Well played, Kayla.
Yes, I definitely encourage them in the direction of cello, bass, even string instruments that, you know, are more tolerable than a screechy violin.
Actually to it. And the smaller you go in the strings, it gets a little hairy. Mm-hmm. So you're right. Yeah, bigger string instruments, no brass in the house.
Yes. And mommy does have to, you know, maintain her mental health after all.
I can tell you, these are the zombie years. You know, you wake up and you go to bed, it's just zombie land. When you're 50, you'll forget like 8 years of your life. It'll just be like a big, it's like a curtain. It's opaque. I know. I remember. And there were birthdays and soccer stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I survived it.
And, but I don't quite remember the details of it. Yeah, I definitely.
That's exactly it.
Unfortunately, I already feel that way about the, you know, my kids are in the middle years now. And quite honestly, you know, to the women out there that are like, oh, how are you running a company and you're a mom and all of that? I tell every woman I know that our life is in seasons for a reason. Like there are seasons in nature and there are seasons of life. And, you know, I didn't go back to school until my youngest was in kindergarten. And now my kids are in the middle years. They're very independent. They can get themselves up and ready and on the bus on their own. And, you know, what I'm doing right now wouldn't be possible when I was in the nursing years, when I was in that season of caring for little babies, cleaning up after messes all day long and expending of my own body, you know, to breastfeed and everything. I couldn't have worked 12-hour days.
No way. I don't think it's no way you can.
Current structures of a lack of support for moms, you know, like I think that there are companies that are really trying to build that in now and give moms the opportunity to even have their babies, you know, with them or work from home and be able to, you know, stay home in those early days. But that's all pretty new, also out of COVID, you know, recognizing that. Well, we kind of sent all moms back home to care for kids and realized, this does not work to not have full-time caregivers. And the moms were really kind of kicked out of the workforce during that time just to save the families. So we've got a lot of repair to do out of that period of time because there are a lot of women that are trying to come back into the workforce and really struggling with that. You know, post COVID.
I look at my daughter. She just had her third and he's about 6 months now and she's, you know, started. So Q4 back on the road, she's a salesperson.
Yeah.
And, so she travels and, you know, it's so painful for her, but she had a good 4 months with maternity and everything in vacation, which is, you know, God, I can't remember what it was with our firstborn. It was like 30 days later, you're back to work.
That's
it was
right.
Brutal.
Yeah.
Just inhumane. And I can see, I feel for her a lot.
Yeah, I was going to say there's European countries that would look at even, you know, the 6 months as not adequate at all, you know, when they're providing maternal leave for a year and then paternal leave for another year. Yes. So that first 2 years of life are really covered with that one-on-one, you know, attachment that I will say is, you know, as a developmental psychology expert, that is a critical period of time. That 0 to 4 is a very special time in a child's brain development. And we have to think as a society about the things that we invest in that build the fabric of our society into, you know, a strong, I mean, sure, you can put it in economic terms, like a strong economy is built on healthy people. But if we don't have, you know, emotionally mature, healthy people, it erodes every aspect of society. But when will we prioritize that? You know, when will we see the nurturing of families as a top priority from every standpoint? You know, I'm waiting for that day.
I'm dying to have a conversation with somebody in one of the large healthcare companies because, you know, it's economically, I lick my finger and I can just hold it up in the wind. And I know monetarily that the amount of people, the amount of expenses and healthcare that is done because of mental health issues not taken care of. I mean,
that's right.
It could be I would just maybe a guess. One third of the entire spend we have is preventable by better addressing children, better addressing, you know, the family and allowing the family to stop these cycles, these, you know, terrible cycles of childhood. I have seen, you know, the interviews I've done 320 something interviews now.
That's amazing.
It's really, you know, when I say the number now, it's just kind of like, because, you know, I was there when I had zero, right? I remember when it was an idea. So like to say I did 300 is like, whoa, is that really true? That I guess I have. And so many people have stopped the cycle, Caitlin. It's so heartening for me that their childhood was, you know, X. And what they've done with their kids is the opposite.
And that's right.
They recognize the damage done to them and how long of the journey they had to fix themselves or to even find out they were broken. I'm broken, but I don't even know I'm broken. And then finding out I'm broken and then how to repair. And it goes back to the childhood stuff and, you know, the traumas in childhood and a lot of attachment stuff, right? A lot of attachment stuff. And through divorce, through separation, through drug use by the parents, and the impact that has, but breaking that cycle has given me, it's like so powerful to hear that story, right? Where they're like, yeah, this is what happened. This is how I'm raising my kids.
That's right. Yeah. It's very hopeful to me as well. And I think that our generation and the generations, you know, coming are so much more self-aware and have a lot more tools at their disposal too. Yes. Mental health tools from mindfulness to, you know, lots of different kinds of somatic therapies and and I lump exercise in that, you know, we don't just have lifting weights and yoga anymore. We have all kinds of different ways to move our bodies. Yeah. Our understanding of nutrition is so much better than it used to be. And just a lot more tools at our disposal. And I think that with that growing self-awareness and building more supports around ourselves and our communities, there is a lot of hope for the future.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're close to turning the corner on a lot of that generational.
Yes.
A lot of the generational trauma that's, you know, and we're getting those cycles broken. And I
think
that's part
of the
awareness.
But it does take a lot of courage to get there. You know, like you're saying, you really admire those people you've met that have arrested a cycle because it is so easy in stress to default to whatever is our default mode, right? So even when I was trying to change my parenting paradigm, I made a big shift from the more controlling and heavy on the discipline parenting style that I was parented with, spanking and so on, you know, and I wanted to parent differently, the more connected, positive lens. And and yet in stress, you go to your default mode. And, you know, so it takes conscious effort all the time to be changing those patterns of our own behavior, you know, and our own, like, okay, this is the direction I go in stress. And it's not the path that I want to move in, but it takes a lot of self-awareness and compassion. It takes a lot of self-compassion, you know, cause we're going to mess up.
We're going to mess up, and you got to give yourself some grace and look back. You're right though. I watch my daughter raise her kids, and I'm just in awe of how amazing they are. And they're such better. I mean, she's such a better parent, her and her husband. They're such better parents. It's like, I look at them, I'm like, dang.
Well, like, and you know,
it's impressive, right?
Right. And my parents, you know, they also, share that same sentiment. And I remember my dad saying that, you know, he wanted us to, he was hoping to do things a little better than his parents did it. And he expected to do it a little better than he did it. And every generation to build on the foundation that the previous generation, you know, lays for them. And I think that's a really important, humble approach now that I'm a parent too. And, you know, my kids will get upset about something and you're the worst mom ever, you know, and you know,
I doubt it.
And I just want to be like, well, just wait till you're a mom, you know, I'm doing the best I can, just that reality of like, no, I'm not going to do it perfectly. And you are going to build on what I've started. And I hope you do parent better. You know, I hope you figure out this screen time thing. That's what I hope you figure out so that your kids aren't living on iPads for their whole childhood.
It's a drug, right? It's impressive.
Yeah. And that's a challenge that our parents didn't have, you know, monitoring the amount of screen time that children have is that's a challenge that previous generations didn't have to deal with.
Yeah, that's for sure. What's the path for you guys? What's the path to get the next steps? When are you going to launch?
Like,
everything was perfect. When do we see you when do I see you on the Monday Night Football TV show?
Oh man. You know, if I could map out a perfect path for these, for these novel compounds. I mean, the truth is when you have a novel mechanism of action and you have the potential of a first-in-class drug, that means that chances are you're going to have a lot of R&D, a lot of iteration. Yeah. And so I'm really thankful that I have a brilliant med chemist on our team and working with a really good synthesis organization too, that we can go back and we can do a lot of iteration. And I expect that. I don't expect that the compounds will be perfect out of the gate. And so, but even so, you know, I would like to see the selection of a lead candidate. So that's a compound I will take, you know, through further testing. Okay. I'd like to see the selection of a lead candidate within a year. And if everything goes perfectly, 18 months, I would like to be doing IND. That's the investigational new drug application, your write-up package for the FDA. Okay. And you have to do IND enabling work. You have to do all of these studies to get to that point. And then you write that up and you hope for a new drug application, an NDA.
Could that be 2 years? Two years for the NDA.
That's right. Okay. You know, so that IND enabling work in 18 months, and 2 to 3 years, hopefully in first in human. That's phase 1 clinical trials.
Wow.
So that's why it takes about 7 to 10 years to get a drug from conception all the way through to. It's a long road, and you know I'm a sprinter, not a marathoner, and I'm forced into the marathoning now. So
how do you finance this thing? I mean, how do you finance this? Cause it's a good thing. I mean, what you're doing is not even just a good thing. It's like, it could be changed. Like you could make a lot of drugs obsolete overnight, like in a whole slew of new versions of what you're doing could come out.
We hope really what we're doing is offering, you know, an alternative to, especially for conditions that, I mean, there's a lot of unmet needs in chronic pain, but there's all kinds of neuropathies, diabetic peripheral neuropathy, chemotherapy induced neuropathy. There's a lot of neuropathies that very much it's the nociceptors, you know, or, firing away when they should be calm. I call
they
them
should be resting.
Yeah, I call them angry pain.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, just calm down, bro. Yeah. Like, you have to be so angry.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of conditions that we hope to address with this nociplastogen program. But yeah, you know, I think looking, the main thing for me is that because of the opioid crisis, because of you know, because there hasn't been a lot of innovation and investment. It takes both. It takes like really innovative teams and technologies and investment.
Yeah. And money.
And there hasn't been that in pain drug development in the wake of what happened with the opioids and everything. So what I'm really hoping to do is push pain drug development into that very, you know, innovative place again and get investors interested in pain again, because you know, the markets for pain are enormous. 1 in 4 people have chronic pain. 1 in 10 are disabled by it. So you talk about economic burden, it's a huge economic burden.
Whoa.
And, you know, and we've got, something has to give, something has to change, because we're, you know, we're losing a giant portion of our workforce because of chronic pain. Even just think about low back pain, how much that impacts, you know, the workforce. So yeah, as far as funding these things, that's why pharmaceutical development is such a costly endeavor, because it's a long road. There's so much testing that has to be done. And, you know, the way our medical system is set up right now, it is about safety of novel compounds. And sometimes, you know, that the safety, I mean, there's a lot of drugs on the market today that would never pass muster now.
I would imagine there's a few drugs on the market that might not make it through today's trials.
That's right. And you do have to ask yourselves, like, okay, so there's also a tipping point there, right? Like, we need access to these medicines that are life-saving, and there is some amount of risk that we all have to tolerate to be able to meet the need. And I feel like maybe we've gone too far in the safety direction. And now, you know, people are really, really suffering without any solutions out there. So, we'll see, but pharmaceutical development is very costly. It's usually backed by venture capital. In our case, since it's a novel approach, we're going to be applying for grant funding. The HEAL initiative out of the NIH.
That's great.
Yeah, they are really smart, looking for a non-opioid pain solution, and they're deploying millions every year to academic institutions and industry. Great. You know, so we're going to be grant writers this year. We're going to be taking all of this preclinical data and writing some very extensive grants and hope to get funding that way. But if there are any investors listening, I am always looking for angels. I am always
absolutely. Yeah. We need an angel.
Yeah. True believers in, you know, in a disruptive, innovative approach to pain, and that believes in a team that's really, really committed. You know, we're not giving up on this. For me, this is the rest of my career. You know, I'm in my 40s now, and I'll take this into my 60s and, you know.
Well, you said it before, which is, you know, it's going to take 7 years, right? It takes 7 years. You're on this journey.
That's right.
There's no getting off the bus for you.
Nope. Like I said, I've been that pain patient. You know, I was on pain meds that didn't work. I was absolutely crippled in pain before my surgery for a year. Was just, and that level of pain does deteriorate your mental health too.
You can't
stay happy. You know, you are depressed all the time because you can't function in that kind of pain.
I can't imagine. I'm not really good at pain. I don't do pain well. I think the universe has done me right. It gave me the zero pain tolerance, and it hasn't induced any real chronic pain for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, you know, it can build our resilience. And I do look at my own pain story and I feel that, you know, I'm a much, I'm a tough cookie. So, yeah.
But for me, I would 100%. Yeah, I would. Yeah, I don't need the, I don't need the, what is that? The moral buildup. I don't need that experience.
No, I don't wish it upon anyone. I don't want anyone to be, you know, pain. I do tell people though, pain is, you know, it's kind of a given in this experience of consciousness and living life. We're going to have pain, but suffering is something that we have some control over. So like I'm trying to alleviate the suffering.
I like that. The pain is real, but the suffering we can find ways to help. I just put up, you know, for anybody listening on the audio platforms, I just put up the cactitherapeutics.com.
Thank you.
So I just put up Caitlin's website, and that's a great place to go and learn and to see a little bit more of the tech, right? You can get a little bit more of a peek behind on what the conversation is around the tech. It's a really interesting site. Caitlin, thanks so much for being a guest.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for having me. I feel like we could talk all day long about all kinds of things, but
We could, we got all kinds of stuff. You know, I want to check back with you in, you know, 6 months or 4 months, you know, like in around February, March.
Yeah. I'd appreciate that.
March,
we will have some exciting developments. I feel like this next year, even this next 6 weeks are really critical for, you know, the experiments that are happening right now.
That's what I had a feeling.
Yeah, but we're also exploring, you know, clinical trials for veterans with PTSD and chronic pain. Again, like the, you know, the psychological aspects of all of this are really interesting to us. And even though we're a long way from shifting that whole conversation into, you know, a more biopsychosocial spiritual model of pain, you know, we're trying to get to that place. You know, we're heading in that direction. And I think this next year is going to be really, really exciting. And in any case, healing is a lifelong journey. That's what I tell everyone. So all of us.
Healing is a life. Yeah. It is a lifelong journey.
It is.
And because we're experiencing life along the way, right? We have these old traumas and experiences in life, and you know, kind of, you got to kind of constantly be, let's say, not repairing ourselves, but just checking in with yourself.
That's right. That's right. It's building the supports around you. Yeah.
Yeah. It is it's a lifelong journey. And this, I think I've met so many people at different ages. And, you know, as people mature, generally what I see is kind of all of that life experience that they've got, the good and the bad, the stuff they've healed, the stuff they haven't healed, kind of comes together and they end up, you know, somehow in their purpose. I don't, you know, this whole life journey is really interesting. So it's kind of, you're kind of at this close of a second, you're like halfway through your second act in a way. You're kind of like at that, you're halfway over that hump on your second act. And as you close out, you know, as you kind of close that out with getting the license and getting approval, it'd be interesting to see once you're sitting, you know, on the power seat of this company, you know, what do you do with that? And how different does it look when you're 60, when you're 55, 60?
Yeah.
It'd be really interesting to see. I wish I could have a flash forward to see what you're doing when you're 60.
Me too.
We'll have you. Me too. Yeah. Well, we'll have you back for that moment.
Oh, sounds great. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this conversation and I really appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you very much, Caitlin. I appreciate it. Hang around for 30 seconds. Say bye in the green room. One more commercial. Thanks everybody for listening, supporting Mental Health Today. Especially if you're on this, if you're seeing the video, that's great. Please share it. If you're on an audio platform, again, just drop down, give us some little love on the ratings, give us a star. And see if you can share the episode with somebody else that could benefit. Thanks, Caitlin. See you in a TN30. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, loose, baby.
But we're about to go and make this vessel with these great professionals in public glass. We're not part of the community, but we're from the outer family of glassblowing. Yeah, we're going to go make a magical giant jar with optic lenses so that if you turn it, it changes all the time. So if you change the way you look at things, the things you look at will change.